Morris Special. In the run-up to a new exhibition at Morris, House for Contemporary Culture in Maastricht, director Valentine Bivank interviews participating artists, performers, and curators.
Very welcome. Good afternoon. My name is Valentin Bayfunk. I'm director of Morris, and at my table today is Arturo Camea and Claudia Martinez Garay. And together they're going to make a fabulous exhibition at Morris opening in March with the title Opaque Spirits. And maybe it's a good thing to start with that title because we've been going back and forth about what the good title would be. Maybe you want to say something about it, Arturo?
Yeah, so the title comes from this very famous phrase in Edouard Glissant's book, Poetics of Relations. And the phrase is the right to opacity. No? And the right to opacity means that societies that are in the periphery of the world also need to have a right to be not fully understood or understandable to the other parts of the world, specifically speaking of the Western centers, because in this globalization era, what is always demanded is transparency. No? But transparency in terms of culture also means that it will flatten and homogenize what culture means throughout the world. No? So that's where the title comes. Spirit is opaque spirits. Spirits is because throughout the house you will have a series of scenarios, and these scenarios are meant to be inhabited by ghosts. But in this case, the ghosts are not transparent beings, but more like opaque entities.
As in murky. You cannot see through them.
Yeah. You cannot see through them, and then they will affect the physical space and objects.
So are you turning Morris into a house of ghosts?
Yeah, everything started with this small interview of Cabrujas, the Venezuelan theater writer. And he was saying, what was the point to have an estate anymore, no? In places like Venezuela, where the state is a game of appearances, no? And appearances in the meaning of, for him, the state in Latin America and in Venezuela is more like a, behaves more like a hotel manager, but in the opposite way. Instead of giving you all the facilities for you to live comfortable, it gives rules and regulations, everything you cannot do in the hotel. And you also feel like, okay, this is not a place that I own. This is a temporary place for me, so you don't make it better, or you don't feel the need to make it better. And also, appearances for me has to do, like the opposite of that is apparitions. So what do apparitions or ghosts, what's their role in a place like this? No? In a place where you have guests, no owners, then why don't you have ghosts instead of guests that can actually go through the walls, actually can interact with the space? These are all full of desires that have never been fulfilled, and instead they've been charged with a great amount of debt that they have to, this great amount of unfinished business that they have to finish.
Yeah. And the apparitions, who are they? Where do they come from? Are they people or situations or histories? Or
I think these are impressions that left lingering afterwards. So in the case of Morris, no, what I'm trying to do, these are actions or desires that never reach what they wanted to succeed, never finish the task, never, like, it, they left lingering.
Such as?
Such as, for example, in one of the spaces, the room is like a hoarder house, full of houses, very full of stuff. But in the middle, there's a table with some objects, and there's a tin can that is moving on its own, like a Ouija board. but mm-hmm. it's actually, when you see it, it's just a domestic scene, could be any table. And then you see two cutouts, wood cutouts, that are actually paintings of yep. two old ladies stretching, but I wanted them to, like, under the right light or under a different context, the table could also be a tomb or a Ouija board, and then these two figures could be like this undead rising from the soil. And this is an older work that is being repurposed here in the context of Marais, but it had to do with all these supernatural stories that we saw in the media in Peru during the 90s. They were manufactured by the government in order to create these smoke screens of what was really happening. I think we are used to by now of these stories, and we ate them up to the point that it became actually something that is part of how information is spread. So you have to separate a lot of what has been manufactured, what is not, and how you understand the relationship between something that is dead or alive through the media.
There is like this very common, let's say, situation. It's like you're waking up in your house, you're having breakfast with your family. In the case of Arturo, I think the butsudan, which is the old altar that is inherited within the family, where the pictures of the deceased family members are kept, that is also next to the living room. So you have like this waking up, having breakfast with your family, having that altar next to it, and also you have the TV next to it, which usually most of the time has a very bloody or I don't know if you say yellow press, like it's
tabloid
news in the morning while you're having breakfast, and then you keep having those kind of memories through the day. But there's always like this scenery where you get used to receiving and absorbing. You have something that can be very difficult to believe, like a supernatural thing in the news. Then you have like a murder that is happening somewhere in Peru, or people raping a woman, things like that. And you have like something more in relationship with a spectacle, like a football player having an affair with a vedette, something like this. So all of these things happen in a room where you're having your breakfast, preparing to go to school. But I think especially in the case of Arturo or certain families, that you have the portraits of the people from your family passing away. It's like a mix of many of those things that are happening together at the same time. So I think in the case of the installation of Arturo with the table, you can see there's something there. There's like an entity, there's a being there, but you're not so sure who it is. You know, it belongs to this space, it belongs to this household or family, but you're not so sure what is the debt that has to be paid, or what is the unfinished business. But you know, it's like a latent being, like a constant feeling there. And I think that has a relationship also with the title of the piece.
What is the title?
Ghosts Are Another Mouth to Feed. The plan for this particular project in Marais is to lay out, before the install process began, lay out, yeah, this room is going to be like this, it's going to be like this, it has a bit of these elements, or maybe you can relate to these other elements, but a lot of the percentage of the work for me personally in this project needs to be done on site. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we are taking a month of install, no? to really affect the rooms with the things we have and with the things we can acquire. What I like for people to see in the work is not so much what they can understand about it, but all the marks and impressions that you left on it that makes you think about the decisions that it was taking there, both rational and emotional decisions, and how that relates to you, no? For example. No? And so a lot of the, for example, the hoarder rooms is a room where I think the process will be to put a lot of stuff, pack it really, and then filter it, discriminating what's going to be in and out until you find the balance and you say, yeah, this says something. No? What it says, half of it will be understood rationally, and half or more than half will not be like that, or it will be from the input of the viewer. There are all things that I've lived with in the past, no? That I've seen it in the past, that I know what I put in there, but I don't also at the same time want to tell the people, yeah, this is it.
The house by itself, it's going to affect so much that it's, I think, kind of interesting how the architecture of this kind of fancy, because it has some ceiling moldings and things like this, with this kind of feeling of abandonment. And that also comes in the form of music. And in the form of music, most of that time, like when we're listening to Latin American songs, yeah, from the Central America or from South America, they have their own kind of special things that we kind of like. From the South, for example, mm-hmm. we have some bands that are really anti-imperialist or that express about the suffering from brown people. You have very diverse mood, but talking about political stuff, that it's quite important. Some things may be perceived or not, of course, the difference of language, but I think in general, the mood, you can have it. And in some of the music that we were considering from Central America, like, for example, we are like thinking all the time of, Ruben Blades or Ruben Blades or Buena Vista Social Club, mm-hmm. that are also some quite important influences when we are discussing. That talk sometimes a little bit much more like everyday thing or banal, more common everyday life situation,
yeah.
where there's always storytelling. But I think it's going to be interesting how we are trying to make these different context messages to be understandable. I think that's going to be a little bit the interesting but also the difficult part.
The exhibition also has its right to opacity, no? To opaqueness.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, you don't need to. I think that Walter de Maria once said that if you cannot understand a work of art in at least 12 ways, then it's not good art. You know, so I think we don't need to define everything that is there, but it is interesting to see if there are specific markers in what your story is, because we don't even know whether, of course, people are going to listen to the podcast or read the text. A lot of people just want to walk through that space like it is a film yeah. that they're in. And whatever they get out of it will be their world, you know, of imagination. Yeah.
But I always planned works and shows like that, like, I personally also, when I visit shows, I want to see everything, and then after that, then we get their additional info. Yeah.
Can I take you back to your very nice description of the Peruvian breakfast? Are these different layers of consciousness? It's the news telling you something. It's the family that is present in the here and now, and it's the altar and the family members that remind you of the tradition and the past and the longer family lines. I would assume they always interact in some way in everybody's household. Is the banality of the situation that which makes the spirit effective?
Yeah, there are different, I think, axes. You were talking before about titles and then the difficulty to find a final title. the main difficulty was to translate the and convey in that translation the same meaning that it is in Spanish, for example, no? And we try different things. We try one that is more a bit more humorous, but even then the humor.
Which one was that?
The title was "Those Who Scratch Where It Doesn't Itch," but in Spanish is "Rasca Donde No Pica." "Rasca Donde No Pica," like literally, will be translate like "It scratches where it doesn't itch," and that phrase was taken from one short story from Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, and he was talking about a Spanish commission that were trying to explain the Bible. I don't remember if we're originary people from Mesoamerica or South America. I don't remember. But anyway, the people heard the explanation from the Spaniards, and they say, "Oh, like that, the Bible thing is good, but it scratches where it doesn't itch, you know, for them." You know? It's like in Spanish, you understand that very quickly, but when you translate to English, it's not that easy. The same thing happens in this case, with installation, artworks. And so some of the things will go through and some of them won't. But I think that's also all right, no? Because percentage of that interpretation has to come from the viewer themselves, yeah. No? And what they have experienced. Right. No?
Just to go on a little bit about to scratch where it doesn't itch. Would that also be a line that refers back to the government that does things but never where the needs are of the people?
Yeah, I think when we were just talking about that phrase in Spanish, we were like, wow, that's like really precise, you know, because it works good with this idea that the state is never really taking care of the things that are indeed needed. But I think it makes sense with what Arturo was mentioning regarding the opaqueness. And I think in general, of course, there's like that translation problem, but also that referencing, for example, how Western cultures relate to the idea of soul or the idea of death or the idea of spirits. I think in Latin American countries, or at least in Peru, the idea of religion is a little bit much different, or the idea of spirituality is a little bit much different. And I think that also informs a little bit how the works are created. And I think most of the things probably we can try to explain a little bit, but for sure it's not going to be fully graspable. So this kind of opaque thing, as what you were mentioning, Arturo, I think this kind of resisting is also very nice as a way to not go to the homogenization of mm-hmm. art or understanding of culture.
Mm. Could you say a little bit more about how religion is viewed or experienced differently in Latin American countries?
In my case, my family mostly is coming from the Sierra, that it's like a mountain part of Peru, where the religious traditions are very much embedded, but they are being also like assimilated within the more traditional or native or pre-Hispanic celebrations. So it's a mix of both of them. And the religious idea is so impregnated in everyday life. It's so strongly that it's quite common. And it's not like when I was coming here in the Netherlands and everyone's like surprised that you have like a Jesus portrait in your house, or that your family has, you know, like the Last Supper next to, in every dining room you have the Last Supper, and that's like really normal, no? I think the conversations in relationship to religion are very, very much different. And Latin America or the certain towns in Peru, the religious part is in a way, I think, unremovable. So I think it's quite interesting to understand that there are certain, let's say, older beliefs or ancient beliefs that because of the process of colonialism and the process of not respecting native cultures. All that makes not liking the native culture in general and not learning that in general in the bigger cities. And right now there's a shifting. And so people are now much more interested in celebration regarding, for example, the sun celebration, the solstice, things like that, or trying to understand much more regarding the diverse gods, not only the sun or than only Jesus, which is, I think, a learning curve process in the cities. So that has been shifted.
Is now, as you call it, a return, but it could also be seen as a reinvention in the cities of these sort of pre-colonial ways of maybe putting certain rituals in their religious belief or celebrating the solstice. But that is like an urban reinvention of something that I think maybe indigenous communities have been doing throughout. So how does that fit with each other?
So, for example, indigenous communities, of course, maintain those things. But in my case, precisely, I came out of my indigenous community and my family had it's like a mestizo family. And they respect some of the traditions that were kind of like coming from old times, like even practicing like even Inca traditions regarding water and things like that. Still in their town, they celebrate and make these things. But I think what I meant is my generation, that it's a generation that around maybe 40 years ago, we had a big conflict in Peru and it was the internal war that displaced many people from the mountain parts to the city. And in the city, there was a much loss of these traditions.
Right.
So my generation, what I feel is now it's coming back to their towns. Like it's finally not warring anymore. They can come back. Like right now, there's like these conversations that are more like, let's celebrate the year, but it's like the Inca New Year, not the Western New Year. Like let's try to embrace all of these things that have been lost because of embarrassing, because you have to hide yourself, because of it was dangerous in the city to say that you come from these places and things like that. So all of those traditions that were only being kept in the indigenous community by the people that had to be displaced, it's been lost. But now I do feel like my generation is coming back, living again in their hometowns and starting to learn much more about those kind of traditions.
Arturo, you come from a family which has a rich Shinto tradition. So for you, the subject of religion is very different.
Yeah, well, my grandparents came from Okinawa to Peru 90 years ago. And then their children were also Japanese descended. They married within the Japanese descendant population. And then so they kept certain things, and certain things they left mainly because of the Second World War, because then the Peru had a treaty with the U.S., so they deported a lot of people from Peru to the U.S. So Japanese people try to hide their Japanese features, no? So language and culture. No? So that's why most of Japanese people from my generation don't speak Japanese. No? And so in our house, we had this, every Japanese in the family had this altar. But in every house is the same. No? You open it, it's a very Japanese thing with the names in kanji in Japanese, and then the ashes and the incense. But then you have the picture of Jesus, El Señor de los Milagros, the Lord of Miracles, like a local, whatever local saint or divinity you want. And then everything is mixed, no? And it's easier to live in that what Claudia was talking about, that flexible fabric that culture molds onto. Mm.
And if your family has Japanese and a Shinto past, then I can understand that in Peru they also adopt, let's say, the state religion, what everybody believes, but would they also include pre-Columbian beliefs and rites?
But what Claudia was talking about, this fact that going to those roots are not looked down, that's very recent. It wasn't like that before.
Yeah.
And I mean, the region is, South America is very conservative in general, but Peru is one of the places where it's even more, like, it's not like Bolivia, it's not like Colombia, Ecuador. They have an spirit that is more vindicating. Peru wasn't like that. Peru was, the independence war was between the foreigners who want Peru to be independent and the Peruvians who wanted to fight for the Spanish crown. So that's our independence story. And the same family names that were very powerful and very rich before independence remain after independence. So that's a context in which Peru as a nation was built, and so very recently.
This is like early
200 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, 200 years ago, and then 40 years ago we had this war conflict between the revolutionary groups and the states, and they were very violent, both. And people in the middle were people in the countryside, not in the capital. No? When it reached the capital, then it stopped. No? Like they captured the head of this group.
Lighting and everything. Path? What was the name?
Shining Path.
Shining Path.
You probably have much more input than me because you work with that.
I think in general what Arturo says, it's very important, and I think it's very difficult that people could understand it. And it feels, sometimes that I explained it and it doesn't make sense. Know that in your own country, you're not able to say where you come from freely because they will associate you in a bad way just because you come from the mountain part, that maybe, you are one of these people that like this revolution or these guerrilla things. And
you're a terrorist, basically.
Literally, those kind of things. But, or that they will just immediately look down on you just because, you have like indigenous features or you come from an indigenous community. So that shift is only recently. And now we are really trying very hard to reconnect. And one of the things to really understand, as we were talking about translation and language before, is like learning the language. So the majority population in Peru speaks Quechua. That's like an official language. It's really not a main important thing for the government in general. Imagine the biggest population you have cannot understand what you say because they speak in Spanish. Imagine if you only can speak in Quechua, but you need to fill out documents that are in Spanish. You need to get your ID that it's in Spanish. You need to learn how to sign for your ID. And that signature, you will only use it one time every 4 years for elections. So then the distance between Quechua-speaking communities, more isolated communities, and the let's say the government, it's so far, like the distance so big, that it's difficult, I think, in general, to fully grasp. Me and Arturo, we started learning Quechua since last year. It's super hard, it's very difficult, but what is, I think, the important thing is how are we able to understand or grasp a little bit of that kind of missing culture or missing cosmovision, that it is so important for us to fully understand where we come from. And I think it's kind of interesting also when once I'm for example, in Arturo's family or his friends that are mostly also Japanese descendants, how are the language codes that they use, or what are the things that are still, you know, remaining after these many generations, how they are being kept or shifted in the context of Lima, no, with the influence that also has the people coming from the mountain part to Lima, that especially, I think it's like a really diverse soup, let's say, but his point of view is much more, I think, different. For example, I've seen it how people see him in the country. We are just walking in the street and they would never recognize him as Peruvian. That's something very hard, no, that you have to go through your whole life.
And this is in Peru?
Yeah.
Okay.
They would immediately tell him like he's from China, or they would do things like that all the time. So this not being recognized also by, like, he's born there, like he's very Peruvian, but still because of this strong racism and not fully understanding all the, you know, Peru has the second biggest migrants of Japanese in the world. We had a former Japanese president. We should be already, you know, not able to do those kind of things.
I mean, that's a much smaller problem, because Japanese community is still like, you have this class systems in Peru, it's very, very easy to recognize, like, white is like the upper, no, class. No, it's like, if you're white in Peru, probably you have money. No? But then Japanese comes like around that. Even if you have money or you don't have money, you are perceived like that. So that's also, you gives you these racist benefits. No, I mean, it's not look down. No? Like, they don't recognize you as a Peruvian, but they don't look down on you. No? So that's a very different case that, for example, people who came from the countryside, they are not only not recognized as a part of Lima, for example, if they live in Lima, but as like the lowest thing. Even though those people are bilingual, because they have to learn Spanish, because everything is in Spanish. And you, if you live in Lima, if you was born in Lima, you only speak Spanish. And if you happen to speak another language, it's probably English, no? Because you want to go. Yeah, we import models from the U.S. Now everybody wants to have the bigger 4x4 car. No? That's the measurement of success. Very different from Europe, no? That you want a small car because of climate change. And we are very, in that sense of succeeding, we are very much like the backyard of the U.S., as most of people say. No? I think the government, up until the 90s and early 2000s, was very white, traditional, like conservator. Now it's not like that. That group left, and it seems like, yeah, we made more money in the private sector. And the ones who took the place are more like urban people from Lima and from other cities in the countryside. And it's a very corrupt state. Not that it wasn't before, but now it's very, like, not hiding the corruption, no? So you can see everything that is happening, and nobody says, like, I was surprised a couple of years ago when the government, I know that the government here, when they quit it was because they were going to steal in the government anyway, but at least it's a symbolic gesture. That would never happen in Peru, for example.
Yeah, there's levels of absurdity that are quite, yeah, like.
Could you give an example?
No, I'm just thinking about Susy Diaz, who was a congresswoman. She was a former vedette.
Like an exotic dancer.
She was one of the best congresswomen we had. Let's say like a Chicholina, something like this. She was really, like, the first, she promised, yeah, I'm going to give my first paycheck And you can literally see some videos of her giving the first paycheck.
And giving the paycheck to?
To poor people.
Oh, yeah.
Like the first time she received her payment as a congresswoman. But in the other hand, you find like other congresspeople that are, you know, having received better education, coming from much more higher class, spending a lot of money just to have like a proper parking space in the Congress, like, or spending a lot of money to have assistant to wash their feet. Those kind of things that are seem quite ridiculous and that make the big headlines in the newspapers all the time. And there's never like an accountability on that. There's never like a moment where you see, okay, yeah, like these Congress people are charging their employees a part of their salary for them. Like obvious bad things that, you know, for less you would be just like expelled from your job. Those minimum things or minimum requirements, they are not present in the government in Peru. We don't have that. Like you see many Congress people that even they're declared by fiscals, they are a criminal group, literally like that. We shouldn't have any Congress person that has killed someone. We shouldn't get a Congress person that has not been, you know, that it's not been accused right now of rape or whatever. Those basic things are not in rule. So when we are talking, me and Arturo, of course we see the problems that are there, but in general we are much more interested in discussing or showing the problematics that come from, yeah, like a little bit where we come from, or in the case of Arturo, that it's more related to the city. And I think you can sense and feel a little bit about that in the exhibition. Like if you enter to this hoarder kind of room, you're going to think, or perhaps it's something very present for us as Latin American, all the ceilings in the houses have abandoned stuff. Like you never have like a ceiling with a terrace. That is for upper class only. In the middle class, you have all the trash that you don't want, and then you have the cords for hanging your clothing. So I think there are some references that are going to be put more in context in each of the rooms of the exhibition that Arturo is planning.
Is there a way in which you work together? Because I see in this conversation that you say, well, and Claudia is doing this, and Claudia says Arturo is doing that. Are you making the schemes of these things together, or are you talking to each other about how it goes? And then now you're in the lead, so Claudia is sort of jumping in here and there or intervening. How does it work?
Well, I think, it is Arturo's solo show. And he mentioned he wanted to collaborate with me. And we were always talking how it's interesting that in the music industry, how collaboration works. And you can see, you know, like amazing albums, and you see, some people making text, lyric, music, or making the choir, or making some kind of things. And we thought it would be kind of interesting that it can feel a little bit like that. So not so, yeah, like it's not, we're not doing a duo exhibition.
No.
It's me collaborating and giving, I think a little bit my perspective on what Arturo's mentioning and those kind of things. So especially we discuss that my input would be much more focused this time in the musical part. Because we've been discussing, Arturo wanted to have the visitor could enter a space and have a feeling. That can change whether it is music or sound or just noise and things like that. So we were just discussing in each of the rooms where he needed this, what are we going to make it, or how are we going to change the effect, or that we want the spectator to have.
Actually, in analogy to the music, we've actually been thinking of calling it this show by Arturo Camea featuring Claudia, no? Yeah. Like they do on an album, no?
Yeah, we also thought about that. And, it changed. I think it changed a lot throughout. At the beginning, for example, it was two of the rooms was going to be Claudia's, no? And then and she was planning to make a sculpture with some motorcycle lights that are kind of conversing with the rest of the work. But then we weren't really not sure how that will end up, because then there was another another consideration with the sculpture, for example, that they needed maybe a bit more time to be a longer exploration.
Yeah, and also I think we had some discussions on how it can feel like there's like my input, but also that makes sense with the whole concept of the exhibition of Arturo. And I think that is the most important thing, because you are going through room, and Arturo has planned that you enter one feeling this, following this, feeling this. So the parts that we are doing are mostly in the middle spaces. It's not like the main room or the first one. It's kind of like in between. And they are rooms that work mostly, like as you will go and see something is moving, something is happening in the space, and you will have some sound music that is going to tell you something or shift a little bit what you're seeing or complementing a little bit what you're seeing, but it's still the same coherent house. Mm-hmm. No?
And it's also, I think it's better to not to be very rigid with the limits of what a person will do. And
of course.
It's more organic in the process than just like the 3D file that we presented. That's mainly for like pinpoint how we start, but then it should be more organic in the process, I think.
You paint a lot, both of you. Those paintings are sometimes also quite small, and they're always like in a way autonomous objects, no, that people can buy or bring home. And this is then this vast installation. What's the relationship between those two?
So I remember the first time we talked, you said something that I actually, the whole presentation comes from it. You said, we in Marais, we prefer not to enter and see your work, but to enter to your work. And so normally it's the other way around, not like institutions are reluctant to do things that can be a bit out of control, both in terms of how the public will move through the space or the budget or the. So for me, it's a painting that you can breathe in. There are limitations, of course, in painting, but I always paint spaces. Mainly, I paint spaces. And I think spaces and objects are vehicles to talk about other things. Spaces, objects, and animals are the vehicles for me to speak about things that otherwise would be either too dramatic to speak with or too romantic. Both of those extremes are not really what I would like for a language that I can use. But the spaces, objects, and animals are, for me, in my case.
Yeah, no, I think also something that it's quite different, that I think it's what is much more exciting, but also at the same time more difficult, because you cannot control it. Like, you just make a sketch of a painting and you kind of have an idea how that is going to look, but how, like, you have make an sketch of this space, and even there it's really, we're gonna have an idea, but it is while the making that many changes will happen, and how will that end is really like surprise. No, I think in a way that gives a lot much more freedom, because it's an installation that has many objects you can move, that I think it's going to be like a very different process than making a painting. No? You're just going to have to play a lot also with light sizes and materials.
It's theatrical in a way, no?
In a way, yes. It's not important really that that wall looks like the wall in the sketch, but it feels like it. So we might not find things that matches the 3D sketch or whatever, but that's when I think the interesting part of the work is coming, the decision making with the assets and the things that you have at hand. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I've been working with objects for a long time here in the Netherlands, and people sometimes asking me, and so how did you bring that stool or that thing from Peru? It costs, how much it costs? And all of the things I work with are from the Netherlands. No? I couldn't afford to bring it, and then it made no sense to bring it. But it's the decision maker that makes it feels, tastes different. No? And that is what is going to be interesting in the process, I think.
I think we're now very close to the end, but there's two things that I want to hear you a little bit about. One is, what is the significance of the fish? I mean, why are there fishes? So
yeah, there's a very important Peruvian artist called Juan Javier Salazar. He recently passed a few years ago. And he was very keen and sharp on the things he pointed out about the Peruvian reality, using his own family story often. He said one day that, for example, the fish in the coastline of Peru, they are swimming happily and they don't know, but they are already sold as a supply for the fish flour companies. Eh? And he suggested that this is the reality in which we live, no, in Peru. And I kind of wanted to, it's not an homage or something like that, but I really like his way of thinking and his like, it's a long story, no, all his life and everything, but always the things that he points out about Peru is a way to rewrite history from a more accurate point of view. And so that's why I wanted to have this wandering fish, kind of not knowing what's gonna happen, but yeah, it's towards the end of the exhibition, then you have this fish.
Every conversation I have with you guys, I feel at the end that we're just beginning. So let's not say this is the end of our conversation, but this is just a temporary stop for a conversation that we will continue at another time. Thank you very much,
both of you,
Arturo, Claudia.
Yeah, thanks very much.
My name is Valentin Beifunk. I was here with Arturo Camilla and Claudia Martinez Garay. This is a podcast for Mares about a show called Opaque Spirits. Thank you.